This is the Garden DC Podcast, the podcast about everything gardening in the Washington, D.C. and Mid-Atlantic region. I'm your host, Kathy Gents. I'm the editor of Washington Gardener Magazine, and we're aimed at gardening enthusiasts, people who grow everything from edibles to ornamentals, natives to exotics. If it grows in our area, that's what we talk about. Welcome to episode 192 of the Garden DC Podcast. In this episode, we talk with M.J. Zaji Axum, the director of the Center for Urban Agriculture and Gardening Education at UDC, all about urban agriculture. The plant profile is on Caria, and we share what's going on in the garden, as well as some upcoming local gardening events and this week's garden tasks in the What's New segment. We close out with the last word on Waiting for May Flowers from Christy Page of Green Prints.
This episode, we're joined by M.J. Zaji Axum. He is an agronomist and director of urban agriculture and gardening education at the University of the District of Columbia, based in Washington, D.C., of course. Welcome, Che.
So happy to be here. So very happy to be here.
Great to have you on. And we're going to talk about all things urban agriculture, or urban ag, as we sometimes refer to it. But before we get into all of that, Che, we want to talk about baby Che. We're going to go all the way back. And we're going to say and ask about your gardening experiences from the beginning. Were you born with chlorophyll in your veins and a green thumb, or did that come later on for you?
No, I was not born with chlorophyll in my veins. I did not grow up on a farm. I did not grow up growing vegetables. So I can give you a little hint about how old I am. So I've been doing this probably half my lifetime plus a few years. So I started this in my 30s and just kind of fell in love with gardening. My first kind of goal was to really be a pharmacist. But I went to, you know, I was getting ready to go to pharmacy school and decided not to. And I'm glad I chose the true pharmacy, the pharmacy. That's where health really starts. So, you know, I worked at USDA for about 20 some years and really got interested into growing food, and went back to school and got a degree in agronomy from University of Maryland, College Park. And I started farming. And so the rest is just history. I just continued to do that and continued to, be involved with that as much as I could. I did not grow up farming. My great grandfather, we came from Alabama in 1918 to the D.C. area. Hmm. They were farmers in Mitchellville, Maryland, and also Deanwood area. But they had a farm in Mitchellville, and they did chickens, vegetables, and some of the best moonshine, I've been told, in the area.
Nice.
But I did not grow up farming. Absolutely not.
Did you ever get back to either of those farm locations?
No. I never knew where those were. I was just told by my, my grandmother that had happened. And I did know and meet and spend time with my great grandfather. But never. Hmm. Never knew all in that information until my grandmother told me about it.
Well, it's nice to know some of those family roots, so to speak. Yeah. And I love the phrase pharmacy with the F.
I think
that is so true. And I remember, I think it was herbalist Jim Duke might have coined that phrase. And he talks about, of course, health coming from there.
One of my good buddies at USDA. Mm-hmm. He gave me my first kernel mint plant he gave me when he was working. He would come to my building every day and have lunch with some of his colleagues, and I would see him and talk to him and pick his brain. And yeah, that's when I first met him, back in the very, very early 80s. Mm.
We do miss him in area gardening and agriculture, because he was such a treasure, and only regret he wasn't around in the age of podcasts for me to have interviewed him.
Yeah. Extraordinary gentleman and a gentleman, true gentleman. Yeah,
definitely. Well, let's talk a little bit about UDC. And for those listeners outside the Washington, D.C. area, can you describe where that is located in the city?
Well, UDC is located in Washington, D.C. It is the University of the District of Columbia. So, as many people probably don't know, land grant institutions start back in the 1800s. So, land grant institutions were a way where, different universities and colleges could kind of experiment with research agriculture and then get that information back out to people in the community. But the interesting thing about UDC in the District of Columbia, it is a primarily urban land grant. Like I went to University of Maryland. UDC deals specifically with urban agricultural problems, as in, University of Maryland and Cornell, Penn State, and all these people like that. They have a rural constituency which they have to address. They have chicken farmers, swine farmers, dairy farmers, and they have all these other kind of research interests which where they have to really solve some of these problems to help growers. The thing about UDC is that it is a primarily urban land grant, and we really specifically are geared toward solving problems with urban growing, urban agriculture.
And what might surprise people if they came to visit the campus. So the central one is right off of, I think, Connecticut. And when you go there, I will say the first impression, Jay, is a giant concrete plaza.
Yeah, it is. Well, the good thing about it, the plaza is concrete, but the great thing about it is, up on the rooftop, we have a 40,000 square foot green roof. When I first got there in 2013, they were not planning to grow any food up on the green roof. And I said, wait a minute, guys, we got to grow food up here. So we grew food up there. But also not just the aspect of growing food there, all the rain that falls on the roof and on the plaza goes to a cistern, and that should be used and can be used for irrigation purposes for the campus. So yeah, it's an extraordinary place. Extraordinary place, yeah.
And I remember visiting during COVID and getting up onto the green roof, seeing that the great cistern system that's above that parking garage, really expanse of concrete. And then you had some small planting areas in raised beds in the back there that students and faculty could use.
There is a actually there's a community garden on campus, and we also have a greenhouse which we're getting ready to ramp back up to a production as far as a aquaponic greenhouse, which will house fish to grow help grow vegetables. Or we will probably maybe switch it back over to hydroponic vegetable growing, but we have all those kind of aspects up on campus to utilize for students, mainly for experiential learning experience, for students.
And you also have nutrition classes and
Oh,
other
yeah,
learning.
nutrition. We have dietetics. We have a wonderful nutrition and dietetics program in causes, and also in causes, the engineering program is in causes, and also the architecture program is in causes. So we get a lot of kind of assistance from them as far as design and build stuff like that. And yeah, the master gardening program, and we have a lot of workshops and courses. Biointensive agricultural production. We have a soilless production class, which is ongoing now, which we have a wonderful person who teaches that, Ariel Burbridge. She teaches that class and basically talks about non-soil production of crops.
And so we should also talk about what causes stands for.
Oh, causes. College for Agriculture, Urban Sustainability and Environmental Science.
That is a mouthful.
Yeah.
So you can
I'm
get a,
surprised I remembered it. Yeah.
yeah, I was going to say that's pretty good. So the DC Master Gardener program is based there, and that's on the main campus. And you have some facilities off of the main campus too for growing.
Well, we do. We have these concepts called food hubs, and they are either encompassing of growing. Some are growing soilless production, like aquaponics and hydroponics, and some are soil-based production, like our farm at East Capitol and Southern Avenue. We have a large urban farm there. We have a farm at Livingston Road and Southern Avenue, which is the P.R. Harris campus. We have a large farm over at the Bertie Bacchus. What they call it, Lamon Riggs campus on South Dakota Avenue, which has a soilless growing, plus it also houses the Master Naturalist program for crop for production of natural for native plants. that is spaced over there. So we have these concepts called food hubs. And over at, you know, at the Lamont Ridge campus, is just tremendous. Over there, we have a kitchen. We have a state-of-the-art kind of kitchen. We have composting classes. So we kind of, you know, at different of the different food hubs, we have these different components which teach different things and bring these information back to the community.
Mm-hmm. And I love that the, especially the Bernie Backus campus you mentioned is really near Fort Totten.
Yeah, and so it's accessible.
Yep, very accessible. UDC campus itself, very accessible by metro and public transit. So
even the East Capitol Farm is right across from the Southern Avenue Metro Station.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
And what type of degree can somebody get from UDC in growing?
Well, they can't really get a degree. Well, put this, they can get a degree. Right now, they have professional master of science courses in urban agriculture. Mm. And they also have a PhD program in professional kind of science of urban agriculture and sustainability. So you can get a PhD, you can get a master's. Then there's, you know, like I said, the nutrition program is there. The nursing program is in our wheelhouse. So you cannot get an agronomy degree, you know, like I have from University of Rhinelander there. But, you know, the thing about it, you can get a lot of experience because we have some wonderful people at the food hubs and at the farm in Beltsville. We have 143-acre farm in Beltsville, which we have classes and volunteer opportunities. So you can come there and learn more than you can probably learn in a, you know, unfortunately, sometimes in a class.
So that growing facility in Beltsville, Maryland, that is on USDA property or
it's on our property.
Oh, know? Interesting.
Land grant institutions all are granted land. Mm-hmm. So from a congressional act, you know, in the '80s, since UDC is a land grant, you know, the different types of land grants is 1865, there's 1890, there's a few different types of land grants. But all of them have land which are associated to them so they can do research. And that's one of the things that all land grants have. So that is 143-acre farm. And we have a lot of great things going on now. We have a beginning farmers program where we kind of choose people who have, you know, apply to be in the beginning farmers program. And we teach them how to farm. And again, at the end of, you know, during their whole process, they are able to grow for sale to restaurants. They want to do a CSA, whatever they want to do. That is the priority of this program that we have there, which is funded by the USDA. Hmm.
And so we should probably rewind a little bit, Jay, and define urban agriculture and talk about some of its beginnings. Because in the history of man, right, we weren't urban. We were out there hunters, gatherers, maybe growing a little bit ourselves. And then we came together as a community and the food needs probably increased.
Right. Well, that's one of my, you know, passions right now. I've been working on this book for the past 4 or 5 years, which is the origins of urban agriculture, the sustainable origins of urban agriculture. There's some places where urban agriculture started, but they weren't as sustainable as one specific place in our history of humankind where agriculture was the most sustainable happens to be the Nile Valley in Egypt. So agriculture was sustainable there for almost 3,000 years. And there were so many reasons why it was sustainable. There are governmental reasons, there's environmental reasons, there are just geographical reasons why it was sustainable. And like I said, urban agriculture is not something that's new. It's happened, you know, in other places, you know. And in my research, you know, I was hoping to, you know, really find the origin of urban agriculture. But urban agriculture maybe starts in a few places, maybe in the Fertile Crescent, which is in between the Mesopotamia and the Euphrates River over that region over there. But the origin of sustainable agriculture really starts in ancient Egypt because they were just blessed by a gift called the Nile River, which acted as a farmer for them. It was the farmer for them. It spread nutrients on the soil every year. It inundated the land and it just acted as a farmer for them. So sustainable urban agriculture starts right there. So that's where it really starts, sustainable agriculture. Now, maybe urban agriculture starts in maybe some other places, similar times and practices, but sustainably, that's the place if you want to look if you are a ecological kind of geographic kind of historian for urban agriculture.
And how do you define sustainable urban agriculture? What are the attributes of
it? I would really define one of the key concepts of defining sustainable agriculture is trying, really not really depleting the land of nutrients and soil depletion as much as you can, and really guarding the environmental concerns of the land as much as you can, and creating a situation where, you're not degrading the land, year after year after year, in a manner that will, lower crop production and will not increase environmental degradation. And, some of that does happen at that time, but very kind of maybe not so often that it happened as in other places where, environmental degradation and silting of the land because the river was lower than the land and you could not remove the silt and the salts from the land. And it was the ancient Egyptians in that area in Sudan and Egypt, they were just blessed by the Nile. Sometimes it was very bad for them, and sometimes it just inundated too much. It just flooded everything, and they would just. And sometimes it did not flood enough, and they were had crop increased and the decreased crop productivity. But sometimes it was for a long time it was the most sustainable agricultural system that the world has ever seen.
And what lessons can we take from those ancient Egyptian urban ag for today's urban ag?
Take care of the soil. Hmm. Take care of the soil and just, take care of the soil, monitor soil loss as best you can, monitor nutrient loss as best you can, and do as best you can in according to, the environmental constraints that you're under. We're in a whole different realm of kind of climate. I don't like to call it climate change. I prefer climate warming. I prefer the term climate instability because that's where we're in now. And just really monitoring that, doing the best you can to, be sustainable as you can as far as your crop production systems are concerned.
And I know that you're interested in climate smart crop production.
Yeah.
Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. About right before COVID, I was approached with a grant from the USDA NIFA, which is the National Food Institute for Agriculture. And we had a farmer exchange and student kind of exchange and dealing with the great Tuskegee University in Alabama. That is where George Washington Carver hailed from. He got a lot of his work he did down there besides other places where he worked at, but he's famous for putting that place on the map. And so they came to me with a program or process or problem solving issue about, just growing crops in greenhouses. So they had many greenhouses down there in the South in Alabama, and it got very hot. And some of the growers were not growing crops in these houses during the summer months because they assumed that it was too hot. So I quickly put my thinking cap on and I said, well, a lot of the crops that we grow, even in the summertime are basically tropical crops. And why aren't they growing? So we looked at some of the tropical crops, and there's so many crops that really have some unique abilities to grow under very high temperature days. For example, there's a tomato called Solar Set, SolarSet, which in many times fruiting crops, tomatoes, cucumbers, peppers, things like that, they produce flowers, and that flower produces a fruit. Mm-hmm. And so under very high temperatures, sometimes in many crops, not really kind of adapted to that, they will have a thing called blossom drop. It will be so hot for 3, 4, 5 days that the blossoms will just drop off because it's too hot. But there are a lot of crops, but there are a few crops that really have the ability to hold their blossoms and produce fruit and a vegetable under these high temperature days.
Can you share some examples of those?
But like I said, solar set, sunflower is a tomato. There's a cucumber called Market More.
Oh, I've grown that one.
There's definitely a Malabar spinach. Trying to think off the top of my head, what else is there?
I was thinking about okra as one of
Okra
my,
is one that,
yeah.
okra is another crop. But I'm just trying to think of the list of crops I had under that fact sheet. But if folks wanted to go and find that fact sheet, it is on the US, I mean, it's on the UDC Causes, CAUSES Causes webpage. And if you go to my center, which is CAGE, CAUGE, which is the Center for Urban Ag and Gardening Education, that fact sheet is available for just downloading. But there are a few crops like that, and I'm thinking there's certain sweet potatoes which produce under very high temperatures. What else? Some varieties of corn which produce under high temperatures. There's a few lists of them, and if you go to that our website and you look for that particular fact sheet called Urban Ag and Climate Change, I have those crops listed on that fact sheet.
Great. We'll try to link to that in the show notes
Yeah.
for everyone. And I was going to ask for your thoughts on some of the biggest urban ag challenges. And I'm going to throw out a few to
Oh,
you
yeah.
for your reactions. And the number one, of course, we just addressed heat and urban heat islands,
Yeah.
but is there a way to mitigate that heat a little bit, maybe
Well,
a
no,
shade cloth or anything?
I mean, you can do shade cloths and you can do some things like that, but again, just increasing your knowledge of specific varietal selections which do well under those high heat temperatures. For example, like all cucumbers aren't created the same. Some do well, some do not too well under high heat temperatures. All tomatoes are not the same. Like I said, the solar set and few other tomatoes, you heat, there's a tomato called heat wave, and there's some of the tomatoes that do well under high heat temperatures. So you really have to kind of search around and really look for those crops. And then, not it's not just about growing those crops. One of my interests has been and is been and will always been increasing the nutrient density and growing crops that have specific nutrient density. So, like I said, all crops are created equally. So for example, there's a tomato called Caro Rich, CaroRich, which is a tomato that was specifically bred to have a higher amount of beta carotene. So there are a lot of crops that are like that, but most growers, sometimes we're just looking for something that probably tastes good. We're not going that extra step to really find out, okay, what is the crop that's going to give me the best multivitamin garden that I can grow?
That's an excellent point, Jay. I would think, yeah, we're always looking for the healthiest looking growing plant, like the least amount of blight. We want disease resistance.
And that is not
Yeah.
always the most nutrient dense crop.
Ah, interesting. And how would, as a home gardener, you be able to tell? Because plant tags don't tell you that. Garden catalogs aren't going to say that.
No, you don't. There's sometimes you can. I know for me, the name of the company that kind of sticks out, they do some work with nutrient dense crops is Burpees. And I'm not trying to, they don't pay me anything, but I'm just saying, I've noticed and just looking at some of the seed catalogs. So just looking for growing for maximum nutrition, just doing your homework and looking for varieties of crops which have higher nutrient density.
That's a great
And
point.
sometimes that doesn't, then there's a whole different class of crops which store well. And some crops store well, store better than others. So it's a lot to it. You have to become a smart grower. You got to do some homework.
Yeah, and I would say my next question for you for urban challenges is not just storage space and capacity, which could be very limiting, in a small space garden or if you're in an apartment or urban household, but also just the space for growing. So when somebody comes to you and says they have no space to grow, what do you say to them?
Well, I say you always have some space to grow because if even if you don't even have to dig up a yard to have a garden. There are a huge, well, not a huge, there's a list of crops that are bred specifically for being grown in containers. One of the things I'm working on now, hopefully to get it done soon, is do a MOU with Yale University. Dr. Ruth Blake up there, she is in charge of a concept over up there called citizen scientists. So in this concept, I've talked to her, and I want to really kind of see if we can get this together. Just have these kind of places and areas where our regular citizens like you and I and other folks can just grow specific crops and have a little science involved in their growing. Do a little research, which variety grows best in a container, which variety goes best in a tub, there's a whole list of crops that grow under shadier conditions. And I have a that website is going to UDC website and going to the CAGE Center for Urban Ag and Gardening Education. There's a video I did there. This is a video growing crops, specific crops that grow under, decreased sunlight. But there's a lot of stuff you can do if you don't even need to dig up your yard. You can just have some containers and pots and, things like that. You can really, there's no excuse not to grow food. Even if you're just growing some culinary herbs. I mean, all the plants that are in the mint family, the oregano, the thyme, the basil, the rosemary, all those plants, I think all those plants are in the mint family, are extremely high in antioxidants. If you're just growing those and cut that up and put it in your salad, just cut it up and put it on your plate and eat it. You don't need to dig up your yard. You can dig up your yard if you have the space, but you don't really need to grow something.
Yeah, and I always say growing your own herbs, if nothing else,
Look,
just a pot of herbs because of the savings, because just a
look.
small little tiny bundle of herbs at the grocery store is going to be more than all the seed packs of those herbs that you grow
Look,
yourself.
I tell people all the time, I say, look, what you can grow on your own in your backyard, if you can grow correctly, whether it's a seed, whether it's an herb or vegetable, you might not be able to even find that quality in the store.
Very true. And you get to control the inputs, what
Yeah.
fertilizer or if there's been any chemicals
Yeah.
applied, everything that went into it. So the next urban challenge I was going to ask you about is water. Having a water source nearby or sourcing water for your garden plot.
Well, I mean, so a lot of us, we use municipal water systems to feed crops. So a lot of people are using rain barrels these days. And so I would suggest this. Rain barrels are a good idea. And from what I understand, I mean, if you can set up a little irrigation system to pump the water out into your garden. And I think they have some small kind of solar pumps, which you can add on to the end of your rain barrel kind of outlet, which can pump the water out under pressure. I would suggest, and I always suggest it to folks, people want to, if you're using rain water, which has been captured, possibly you might not want to do overhead watering with that. And you know why the reason for that is? Well, anytime you have water coming off a roof or any other place like that, a lot of times you have pathogens. You have bird droppings, you have these other things. And so sometimes these pathogens are in the water in the rain barrel, and you don't really want to spray those as far as overhead watering into the leaves of your vegetables. You can safely do that through a drip irrigation at the root level, and that won't impact upon your food safety. I would suggest that if you're gathering water from a rooftop.
Yeah, I've heard the same that sediments on the roof, it could be the roof material itself if it's made out of asphalt, all of that.
Well, I would be more the asphalt probably will settle to the bottom of the tank. You might not get that if you're overhead watering, but the pathogens, that for me, that would be my concern, my biggest concern, the
Yeah,
pathogens.
I could see that. So then the next biggest urban ag challenge that I get asked a lot about, Jay, and especially in DC, and I hate to say it,
Oh yeah,
it is the vermin, it's the rats.
I know where you're going. So that's I mean that can be solved. Because say if you have a just picture this if you have a 2 foot wide by maybe 3 foot or 4 foot long raised bed. Mm-hmm. What you have to do really to keep the vermin from really getting in that or underneath that, you have to do some metal kind of, even chicken wire or something like that. And it has the apron up the side of your box and it has the apron out maybe like a foot or 2 feet. You have to keep that free of weeds so you can see if anything's burrowing under it. But then you have to put over top of that a hoop, PVC hoop or metal hoops, with that same wire again over top of it where they can't get in. And believe me, if you can get the right gauge of wire or construction mesh or whatever, sunlight will get in, rain will get in. And believe me, if you have anything to choose through that, you need to move.
Yeah, I would think a good hardware cloth.
Yeah.
You know, wear gloves when you handle it because sometimes kind of sharp edges.
If they chew through that, you need to move.
Yeah, metal is pretty much it. So, as far as being able to, but yeah, making a metal cage.
No deterrents, there are no herbs you can put around your plant. Mm-hmm. There's no, you know, burning sage at moonlight to keep them away. No, forget about it.
Yeah, and they're here and they're here to stay. I think.
Yeah, they were here before we got here, and they're gonna be here after we leave. Mm-hmm.
And yeah, wherever humans are is where they are. So they're gonna help themselves, and of course they like whatever we eat, so it's gonna be the same.
Well, yeah, I've always, you know, in my gardening or farming, whatever, that's, you know, like at the farm in Bellsville, one of the first things I put up was a deer fence. Mm-hmm. I put up a 8 foot deer fence. And so once I put the fence up, they were not at the parking lot meeting me when I got out the car. I worked too hard to really let things like that disturb my kind of farming experience. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think a lot of gardeners have given up because of the deer, but yeah, really it's fencing that you need.
I mean, but the deer, if you have a backyard, again, raised bed, PVC hoops, mesh, over your garden bed. Deer will not get through that.
Mm-hmm. Great recommendations. So when you are out and about in the world of urban ag, visiting other cities or countries and their urban agriculture installations, what are you seeing as the future of urban ag? What are those new developments?
Well, I mean, you know, the future really needs to be, you know, I was in, last year this time, I was in a Far East. I was in Tokyo. I was in Kyoto, in Malaysia. But the future is really just getting more young people interested in what urban ag and the benefits of urban ag is. And so, you know, especially when I was in Japan, and just you know, it's not a large country, but every aspect of land that was vacant, they could grow something on. They were growing, and I was just blown by just riding on the bullet train going past people's homes. People were growing tea in the backyard. Tea. You could see that with tea, with the manicured mounds of tea in their backyards. And a little rice paddy, a small rice paddy. And so, yeah, small is beautiful. There's a Buckminster Fuller book on that, or Schumacher, or something like that. But the book is called Small is Beautiful. And it talks about, you know, it doesn't have to be a very large installation that you're growing, but just make it small, make it compact, try to do it biointensively. Can grow a lot of food in a small place if you do it correctly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I mean, this just getting young people involved. That's the key, you know, just trying to do it as sustainably as possible, you know.
And are you seeing a lot of interest in the incoming student bodies?
Yeah, I'm always impressed by the amount of young people. I mean, when I got started with this probably, and, you know, when I first started doing this probably, late 80s, mid 80s. I saw a few young people, but right now it is a super abundance of young people really doing this. And so and the advancement of the internet is good. So sometimes they're getting a lot of information from the internet, but sometimes, you know, information from the internet, you got to really kind of weave through it and sift through it and find out what works and what doesn't work. And so, but that is really, I mean, that's, you know, this ongoing, you know, new food revolution is something that's going to be here for a while. And I think it's going to be more and more, it's, you know, especially young people just kind of find out, you know, that, hey, if we can do this, we can grow some food, we can save some money, we can make some money, doing this. And for me, it is, you know, this plant a human interaction with plants, and again, thank God for the for our ancient kinfolk, some of the great people who dealt with plants and growing. Finding out who were the first farmers. At one point, we had to chase down animals, but at some point, somebody decided to put a seed down and wait for that seed to sprout something and stay there. Who? Yeah, those first farmers. They're probably women. They weren't men. I doubt if they were men. They were probably women. And hats off to the people. We talked about ancient Egypt earlier. I mean, one of the people that I'm fascinated in history about is the Queen Hatshepsut. Have you heard of her? Yeah, she's the first great to document plant exploration. She's the first person to really document going to East Africa and bringing to the land of Punt and places like that, and to bring plants back to Egypt. She's the first to really document that. Other people kind of did it, but she's the first to really document it. And relics on the tombs of the pyramids and places like that. She's the first to do that, so man.
So I'm going to consider her also the first garden communicator and writer.
Oh yeah,
Yeah.
please do. Yeah, I do. There's some other people who did some kings who did stuff, but she seems like she's the first one to really, we're talking about 1500 BC, 1500 BC. That's 1,500 years before Christ touched this planet and was born in this planet. She was doing that. Set out ships to bring plants from the land of Punt, which is the northeast African coast. Yeah, amazing.
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 And I was going to say, no pun intended as far as
Yeah.
maize and corn,
Yeah,
right?
yeah, 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 yeah. No, yeah. I mean, just absolutely. She's the beginning of organized plant exploration.
Excellent. And so we have a little bit of time left, and I know you wanted to talk about spiritual agriculture in the commercial world.
Well, I tell you, this whole thing about this spiritual agriculture in the commercial world. I mean, it's just when I think about for me that this goes back to George Washington Carver, the saint and scientist. I'm just always just amazed by all the things that he did. When you look at the work that he did, his spirituality as far as agriculture and growing and the soil and plants and all that were concerned. I mean, I haven't. I'm sure there's some probably people who have done it, but I have not read or seen anything about anybody that comes close to him as far as doing what he did from a spiritual perspective. And a lot of people don't know this. I mean, George Washington Carver, he was an agronomist, he was a botanist, but his first degree when he went to Simpson College in Iowa, it was not in plant science. It was not in agriculture. You know what it was in?
I'm gonna guess theology.
No, it was in
No.
music
Ah,
and
okay.
art. So he then goes on after that. He goes to Iowa State and gets his master's degree in botany and things like that. But then his PhDs, the two or three PhDs he have, are honorary. So you're talking about a man with an incredible mind as far as being able to communicate with the spiritual aspects of growing food and science and in the community and the garden and the woods. I mean, so I'm talking about that type of just that kind of that just type of that reverence for the land, bringing that spirituality back into agriculture. And I don't care. Whether you are, my practice Buddhism, or whether you're a Christian, where you're a Muslim, that connection is there. You just need to tap into it.
And I think if you look at a lot of our religious texts in the Bible and the Quran, so much of it is agriculturally
Oh,
based.
I tell people, some folks that, one of the things I like to do is, go to church. I'm starting up a church. I'm starting up a garden at a large garden at one of the church in PG County. Yeah. I said that book that you carry to church on Sunday is an agricultural textbook. It is. There's a whole, there's a book. I've introduced this book to a few people, but it's still available out there. It's called Gardening and Farming in the Bible. That is a mind-blowing book because every aspect of gardening or farming that is in the Bible has been put in this book. And this reading about the gardening prophets, what they did with composting in the Bible. I mean, so many of these things right there are in the Bible. In the Bible. Now, I don't know about the Quran or the Torah or, you know, anything else, but I just know that they are in that book. That is a guardian textbook. And it might be the same thing for other religious texts, you know, whether it be Islam or Judaism or, you know, whatever.
Mm-hmm. I think very similarly. So in our last few minutes, I wanted to ask you, Jay, what do you like to grow best yourself and eat? What are some of your favorite crops?
You know, right now I'm telling you, my, you know, I like to eat everything. I didn't eat okra or beets until I started growing them myself a long time ago. I didn't eat beets or until I grew them myself and grew them correctly at the right size and the right time they need to be harvested. Yeah. And eating okra raw now, and I eat okra raw all the time now. Mm-hmm. Beets, I eat growing beets, which are not too big. They're about a little bit 3 to 3 inches in diameter, no more than that. I mean, just a lot of stuff like that. But I think my go-to crops really are the dark leafy green vegetables. I remember last year, I was really into broccoli leaves. Because broccoli, the leaves of the broccoli have more vitamin C than the heads. So I was growing broccoli and eating the leaves. But my thing right now is one of the crops that I cannot find in the store. They have it in the store, but what you grow, like I said, what you can grow is on your own is better, is arugula.
So true. Yep.
The arugula that you can grow on your own, if you buy arugula in the store, it's different. That's all I can say. It's different.
Yep. And I would say arugula is one of the easiest greens to grow. Pretty much self-sows itself if you let it.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. And just have to catch it, you know, before it gets too spicy or, you know, hot in the summer.
Yeah, so arugula, and that's probably my, you know, right now, if I could grow more of that, you know, personally, I would do that. And then just the herbs. I mean, the parsley that I really was into last year growing, and I use it in a lot of, in like cooking, is called celpar, C-E-L-P-A-R. Mm-hmm. It's a hybrid of celery and parsley. Mm-hmm. And if you cut it and grow enough of it and put it in anything that you make and cook, soups or you're cooking, whatever, and you put it in there, it just enhances whatever you're doing 1,000%.
Yeah, I was going to say, that one has a pretty bright green taste to it. On the celery side.
And parsley is just a huge, huge champion as far as nutrition and vitamin in the garden. So yeah, definitely parsley and, you know, the oreganos and thyme, you know, stuff like that is easy to grow if you don't have a huge land area in your yard. But I would say today, go buy some get some parsley, oregano, thyme, get some of those things like that. Put them in a pot, in a large pot, grow them in your backyard. Start there. If you're not growing anything, start there.
Mm-hmm. On your deck, on your front stoop or balcony. Any of that, whatever space you have. How can our listeners contact you and find out more?
They can definitely go to the UDC website and go to the causes, the College of Urban Ag and College of Urban Sustainability and Environmental Science. And my center, which I'm the director of, is the CAGE, C-A-U-G-E, which is the Center for Urban Agriculture and Gardening Education. If you go to that there, sometimes the website can be a little kind of puzzle-like, but try it and, you know, you can go there, find that, send me an email. Come on, take some classes. Come on, visit the farm. Come on, visit the farm. Come out and volunteer at the farm.
There you go.
Come out and volunteer. We have a wonderful volunteer coordinator just waiting for people to come out and volunteer at the farm. And you will be blown away about how much you can learn and really showing you how much you can do. We have some very experienced people out there. And life changing for you.
And so any final thoughts, Che, on urban agriculture and what people can grow for themselves?
Yeah, well, definitely urban agriculture. But I'd like to end this conversation with ending on this note. You know, one of the concepts I've been really kind of very interested in the past probably 10 to 15 years is the concept of urban agroecology. So agroecology and urban agriculture sound like they're very similar, and there are some slight similarities between them, but there are some huge differences. I can say this for urban agroecology. One of the things I really like about agroecology, which is the if you there's a book called Agroecology. It's Agroecology. And this book is by a gentleman who I've met a few times. His name is Miguel Altiari. That's Altierei. He's one of the foremost kind of guys dealing with urban with agroecology in general. But agroecology, is interesting, especially urban. It has a social context to it, socially, as far as food justice, food equity, and all these things. So I would advise folks just to do a little homework and just looking into agroecology, and specifically urban agroecology, and see how it really can fit into your landscape, how it can fit into your community, how it can make the world a better place. That's your homework for today.
All right, so we have our walking papers or an assignment
Yeah.
to go. Thank you so much, Jay, for
Hey.
sharing this with us. And
It's been a blast.
yay, I was going
Yeah.
to say, I learned so much, and this is a
Oh,
great
that's good.
session.
Yeah. And I appreciate you guys and Kathy, what she's doing. I've met Kathy a few times and I've seen her at different events and talked to her, and I stop and talk, but this is the first time I said something. I just woke up one morning and said, "What? It's a call. You need to do Kathy's podcast. Why aren't you doing that?"
I'm glad you made that connection, and
Yeah.
we'll see
Cool.
you at an event here in DC soon.
Yeah, cool. Everybody, grow some food.
All right.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Caria plant profile. Japanese Caria, Caria japonica, is a deciduous spring blooming shrub with clusters of yellow blossoms in early to mid spring. It is a member of the rose family and is also known as the Japanese rose, Easter rose, and bachelor's buttons. It is native to China, Korea, and Japan. This shrub thrives in part shade and prefers well-draining soils. If you plant it in full sun, the flowers will quickly fade. Caria can grow to 7 feet tall and 9 feet wide. It is hardy to USDA zones 4 to 9. It doesn't need any fertilizers or other amendments. It produces multiple stems. The cane-like growth can be tamed by pruning it shortly after the flowers end for the season. You can cut any stray suckers out to control weedy and leggy growth. This plant benefits from an occasional hard pruning back to the ground every few years. Caria attracts butterflies and hummingbirds to its abundant flowers. It is deer resistant and drought tolerant. Cultivars include Pleniflora, which has double flowers, Albiflora, which has a single creamy white flower, and Golden Guinea, which grows to only 3 to 5 feet high and wide. Caria, you can grow that. What's new in the garden this week? Well, my epimediums are blooming, as well as the golden ragwort and camassia bulbs. The garden tips we shared this week included that it's time to set out your hummingbird feeders and to prune your azaleas shortly after they finish flowering. You can also add a little lime to the soil before planting, and it will sweeten your salad greens. The April 2024 issue of Washington Gardener magazine is posted online now, and in it you can read about long-blooming catmints, our spring garden tour listing, sipping on the azalea cocktail with the recipe included in that issue, two exceptional native ephemerals, combating fungus gnats, great garden books reviewed, salad greens that include endive, escarole, mustard, and cress and how to grow them, and that 2024 is the year of the lily. In local gardening events, some upcoming ones you might want to attend include my series with Brookside Gardens called Gardening Basics and Beyond, and that takes place on 3 Thursdays in a row, Thursday, May 2nd, and then the following 2 Thursdays, you can enroll for 1, 2, or all 3 sessions of that, and you can do so through the Active Montgomery app. This class is aimed at first-time homeowners and beginning gardeners, but intermediate and more experienced gardeners will get something out of it as well. And then on Friday, May 3rd, Saturday, May 4th is the Ladue Topiary Garden's 16th Annual Garden Festival in Moncton, Maryland. On Thursday, May 9th is the Bethesda Community Garden Club's annual plant sale, and that's 9 a.m. to 12 noon at the Farm Woman's Market in downtown Bethesda, Maryland. Friday, May 10th, Saturday, May 11th is the Baltimore African Violet Club's Joppa Grand Market. And it's the year of the African Violet, so it's a great time to go and pick out some African Violets to add to your collection. You can find out more about that sale at BaltimoreAfricanVioletClub.org. And then Silver Spring Garden Club, my club, is hosting our annual Garden Mart fundraiser plant sale on Saturday, May 11th, 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. at Brookside Gardens in Wheaton, Maryland. We have herbs, veggies, annuals, and perennials. It is rain or shine. Come to the visitor center's outside terrace for the sale, and you can find out more about that at silverspringgardenclub.com. Then Saturday, May 18th is Spring Garden Day, the big plant sale at Green Spring Gardens in Virginia, and that is friendsofgreenspring.org. You can find out more details in the list of vendors who will be at that. Growers and extension master gardeners will be on hand to help with plant selection and offer gardening advice. Home baked goods and treats will be available at their bake sale. There's also a used book sale. And finally, mark your calendars for May 20th, the first annual Reduce Your Lawn Day. And you can take the pledge to reduce your lawn at reduceyourlawnday.com. And I invite everybody to spread the word about this new holiday to your local communities, groups, garden clubs, etc. Happy gardening!
Get low-maintenance alternative to lawns with the new book Ground Cover Revolution by Kathy Jentz. Reducing the lawn is among the biggest trends in homeownership, with an endless stream of homeowners looking for an eco-friendly alternative to a traditional, everyday grass lawn. In the last few years alone, over 23 million American adults converted part of the lawn to a natural landscape, and now are looking to do even more. The biggest challenge to adopting this new ideal, the perfect lawn, is knowing how and when to replace your turf and which plants are the best ones for the job. Ground Cover Revolution is here with all the answers you need. Included are 40 in-depth profiles of plants that are perfect choices for replacing a grass lawn. There are options for sun, for shade, for dry and wet sites, and for various climates around the globe. There are choices that bloom, options that are evergreen, and selections that are deer resistant. Author Kathy Jentz has also included an incredibly useful chart that gives you all the details on each of the 40 choices for quick reference and to make your ground cover selection process even easier. Whether you want to replace the entire lawn or just reduce the amount of land dedicated to turf, Ground Cover Revolution will help you usher in a new and improved idea of what a beautiful lawn should be. Available at bookstores now and also at Quarto.com, where you can get 30% off using discount code GARDENING30. In the new book, The Urban Garden, by Kathy Jensen Terry Spade, you'll find dozens of inspiring and creative ways to grow flowers, shrubs, vegetables, herbs, and other plants in small spaces and with a limited budget. Whether you want to grow on a balcony, rooftop, front stoop, or a tiny urban patio, turn your growing dreams into reality and build a gorgeous and unique garden that showcases your personal style while still being functional and productive. With the ingenious ideas and resourceful tactics found here, you'll be maximizing yields and beauty from every square inch of your space while also making a lush outdoor living area you'll crave spending time in. Whether you're growing edible plants or beautiful flowers, the 101 amazing growing ideas found in The Urban Garden will turn your tiny urban yard into a treasure trove of green you'll be proud to share with family and friends. Buy your copy today at your local retail bookseller or order it online now at Amazon.com or bookshop.org.
This is Christy Page with Green Prints on Waiting for Mayflowers and Embracing the Challenges That Precede the Triumphs. Ever since I was little, I have loved the phrase, April showers bring Mayflowers. It reminds me of the rejuvenation that comes each year. As a child, it was a very simplistic view. April would be wet and rainy without much chance to play outdoors, but it would all be worth it in May when all of the beautiful flowers were in bloom. As I grew older, I found myself adopting a more philosophical view of this phrase. It serves as a reminder that sometimes we must weather the storm to enjoy the bounty that follows. There may be days with dark clouds overhead and showers falling, but when the clouds part and the sun shines through, there is usually a rainbow to light the way. Every year, April begins cold, rainy, and raw, and I feel the urge to hunker down and hide indoors. I long for warm days when sunlight kisses the green leaves and vibrant petals open each morning. I tend to forget that to experience the beauty of those petals and sun-kissed days, we must embrace the chilly rain that coaxes the seeds into growing. The same holds true in life. Anything that we truly aspire requires some amount of work and sacrifice. We need to stand in the rain before we can follow the sunbeams and rainbows to our own personal pots of gold. It is the rain that nourishes our abilities and allows us to grow as individuals. Instead of hiding from the rain, maybe it's time to embrace it. Plant seeds during a soft morning mist and watch the soil happily accept the moisture. Plant a bulb on a dreary overcast day while envisioning the joy that will come as the first shoots push through the ground. Till the earth, when it still holds on to the chill of winter, knowing that it will soon be warmed by the summer sun. This is how I want to spend my April, not hiding and wait for the showers to clear, but embracing them and the promise of new growth that they hold. There may even be some time left before the skies darken too much to do some singing and dancing in the rain. And once the sun begins to set, I can move indoors and enjoy a little Gene Kelly, who certainly knew how to do it best. This has been Christy Page with the last word from greenprints.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Thank you for listening to Garden DC. You can become a listener supporter for as little as 99 cents a month by going to anchor.fm/gardendc/support. Another way to support this podcast is to subscribe to our monthly digital publication, Washington Gardener Magazine. To do so, go to washingtongardener.com. Thank you. Thank you for listening to Garden DC. You can become a listener supporter for as little as 99 cents a month by going to podcasters.spotify.com/pod/show/gardendc. Another way to support this podcast is to subscribe to our monthly digital publication, Washington Gardener Magazine. To do so, go to washingtongardener.blogspot.com. Thank you. You can find and follow Washington Gardener on Twitter/X, Instagram, and Pinterest at WDC Gardener, and on Facebook at Washington Gardener Magazine. Please take a moment to rate and review this podcast on Spotify and Apple. Open the Spotify or Apple app, search for Garden DC, check on the rate button, and select 5 stars.